Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. But do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping. FBI's national security letters. State secret privilege. TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list. Persecution of government whistleblowers. Perpetual wars. Rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to The Boiling Frogs. With Sibel Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. Today, our guest is Chase Madar, who returns to The Boiling Frogs podcast. He is an attorney, and he is the author of The Passion of Bradley Manning. And we're going to discuss the preliminary hearings that have been held so far at Fort Meade, Maryland, in the court-martial of Private First Class Bradley E. Manning. Chase, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter and Sibel.
So let me quickly just thumbnail the situation. We've had a series of preliminary motions presented to the court-martial, as a result, there have been some very interesting testimony that we'll cover here in the next few minutes. But the big story is that the trial itself has been moved back to mid to late March of 2013. And I take that to indicate that the judge feels that some of these issues raised in the preliminary hearings are substantial, and it will take some time to review and evaluate them. And Chase, first and foremost, it appears that attorney David Coombs has successfully created the basis for a sort of plea bargain, not exactly the same as we would see in criminal courts on the domestic side, but as I understand it, it will result in a reduction in the number of charges against Bradley Manning in exchange for his acknowledgement that he did, in fact, provide information to WikiLeaks. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I'd say it's an optimistic characterization. It's very true that defense attorney David Coombs and his client have taken the first step in the very delicate dance of reaching at some kind of plea agreement. But they haven't gotten there yet. And what the defense and the defendant have offered is to admit to the facts in the case, and that would probably be offered up in exchange for the more serious charges of violating the Espionage Act of 1917 and the charge of aiding the enemy, those two charges getting dropped. But it has not been accepted as such, and it is still a little too early to see this as a clinched deal between the judge, the prosecutor, and the defense. We'll see how much longer this goes on. Considering that and working out an agreement may be part of what why the judge wants to delay the case yet again. But I think the government has so much vested in this case already that it's hard to see them really dropping the serious charge of aiding the enemy, even if I'd say there's only a 1 in 3 chance that it will stick.
Well, and from what I've read in coverage, it appears that the judge in this case has not been willing to entertain arguments from the defense related to the actual impact of the cache of leaks. And Coombs has been prepared to, I think, demonstrate that there has been no serious consequence in terms of exposure of covert operatives or methods, and also in terms of any identifiable loss of life or harm to individuals who might have been embarrassed by the disclosures in the State Department traffic, what are called cables, but that's just a fancy name for emails these days.
Yeah. Yes, and that's an incredibly important topic in the whole WikiLeaks story, even beyond this individual court-martial, because for the past 2 years, many observers and journalists have been straining to find any real damage, whether to U.S. soldiers or allied soldiers, whether to Afghan civilian informants who collaborated with the ISA troops in Afghanistan, or with State Department sources. And in spite of all these apocalyptic predictions of damage being done, diplomatic Armageddon, lives lost, accusations of WikiLeaks and Private Manning having blood on their hands, no one has been able to come up with any damage being done whatsoever. And now the defense attorney, David Combs, has been filing motion after motion to make the prosecution, which is the government, produce the internal damage reports made by the Defense Department and also made by the State Department. And these documents are, of course, secret and classified. They haven't come to light yet. But we can surmise from the government's position so far that these damage assessments show very candidly that there really hasn't been the serious damage or even mild damage done yet. Now, it's the prosecution's position that what damage the leaks may or may not have done is totally immaterial to the charges at hand, that all that matters is whether Private Manning broke the law by improperly disclosing this classified material, and material that is also, let's not forget, not even classified. Half the State Department cables are not even classified. That's their position, that it doesn't matter what the harm is. All that matters is that he did it. The judge has not indicated whether she finds this completely persuasive yet. It's highly likely that this will come into play when it comes to sentencing. And the likely assessment that these leaks did no damage will probably mitigate a tough sentence, which is surely going to be asked for and may even be achieved by the prosecution.
And Chase, just to recap, to the best of my knowledge, the entire body of information allegedly released to WikiLeaks by Private Bradley Manning does not rise above the level of secret in our classification system. And again, as far as I know, there is nothing top secret that has been released in these hundreds of thousands of documents.
That's absolutely correct, Peter. Out of the 650,000 or so documents that have been released, not a single one is top secret. Many are not classified at all. And in comparison, all 6,000 documents comprising the Pentagon Papers were, without exception, top secret. And yet Daniel Ellsberg is viewed as a hero by many today.
And Chase, let me take this opportunity to play for our listeners a muddy audio recording of an exchange between President Obama and a gentleman who attended a fundraiser here in San Francisco. And it was in April of 2011. And this is a courageous group of people with deep pockets who paid $5,000 each to attend a breakfast fundraiser for the president. And they entertained him with a little song that they kind of forced on the president. And he was trying to be a good sport and listen to it. But they raised the issues of the treatment of Bradley Manning. And afterward, in what we're about to hear, and I invite our listeners to turn up the volume and listen very closely, you will hear this individual talking with President Obama. And he makes the point, he compares Manning to Ellsberg, and the president says, no, you know, we can't just make the law, we have to live with the law. And then he flatly states, and this part is quite audible, that Bradley Manning broke the law. And this is an important indication of the bias of the commander-in-chief and the prospect that his bias will be reflected by the judge and members of the court in this court martial. So here is the recording from April 2011 in San Francisco.
So, people can have philosophical views about on an open source. That's not how the world works. And you're in the military, and I have to abide by your
And right at this point, the president is saying that he has to abide by the rules of classified information, which is actually not true. The president has the unilateral authority to declassify any bit of information he wishes to at any time. Let's continue.
But I'm not authorized to read them. I'm breaking the law. We're a nation of laws. We don't individually make our own decisions about how the laws operate.
At this point, a security individual tried to separate the president from the questioner, and the president said, no, he's being respectful, and he goes on.
He broke the law.
He broke the law. That's what the president flatly says about Bradley Manning. He broke the law.
Well, what he did was he's dumb. No, it wasn't the same thing.
And that's where the president makes the comparison. He says, no, it's not the same thing. And he mentions Ellsberg by name. And he says what Ellsberg released wasn't classified the same way. But what we need to clarify here is that the information released by Daniel Ellsberg was included materials that were top secret. And that's something that has never been alleged in the case of Bradley Manning. Chase, what is your comment about this prejudicial remark made by the President of the United States?
Well, 2 points, Peter. First of all, this is absolutely improper command influence. And I was privileged to hear Manning's defense attorney, David Coombs, speak out for the first time on Monday night in Washington, D.C. And he spoke about the immense challenges facing his client Manning and him as the attorney when the president of the United States declares Manning guilty like that. And that's really just the tip of it. You've had Mike Rogers, now the senior Republican on the House Intelligence Committee, very cavalierly recommended the death penalty for Bradley Manning back in 2010. And many people have very casually just called for his quick execution. Will this have any impact on the actual court martial, and will it scuttle the whole thing because of improper command influence, which in the military justice system is a major no-no? Of course not. There's no way that the judge will scuttle the whole thing. Now, the second point is to address the president's plea for the universal rule of law when he says, hey, guys, he broke the law. You can't do that. Let's not be under any illusions that this law against leaks is uniformly enforced. It has not been under the Obama administration, certainly. Obama's former chief of staff, Bill Daley, gave a very revealing interview with Politico, the website, saying that, hey, I'm all for leaking as long as it's organized. And he even called his predecessor, Rahm Emanuel, the leaker in chief, because Rahm Emanuel was very famous for leaking, spinning, and then massaging these leaks with his contacts in the press. During the Obama administration, we have had high profile leaks of material that is secret or top secret from ambassadors, from generals, from the intelligence community. And you know what? I'm not complaining either. I think these leaks have been entirely positive. This is how we know what our government is doing. The real problem that we have is this overkill of secrecy that stifles and starves meaningful public debate. It's not the leaks. And I don't want to single out the Obama administration either, because every presidential administration in modern times has leaked like mad, and complaints about leaks go back well past the Ford presidency, which is one of the reasons why former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who served at the end of W. and Cheney's administration and the beginning of Obama, said, hey, all foreign governments know Washington leaks like a sieve. And then he went on to say that the whole WikiLeaks consequences are, in his opinion, seriously overwrought. So that's what we have. We have elite impunity for high officials in Washington who can leak to reporters and get away scot-free. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. But then when a private does it, suddenly you have a stern lecture from the constitutional law professor in chief about the value of the rule of law and how you can't break the law. It's absolute hypocrisy, and we should see it as such.
Well, I have several questions, but before I get to those questions, I just want to talk about how I've been looking at this case, because as we know, not many people are talking about Bradley Manning. Not many are writing about Bradley Manning. In fact, here, even in what's supposed to be a very, very highly educated city that I just moved in, when I bring up Bradley Manning, nobody has heard of Bradley Manning. And a few who kind of nod, they say, oh, you mean the military guy who engaged in espionage? Okay. So how I see it is, I know those very few who have been, many of them actually, who have been talking about it, they kind of get bogged down in all the details and semantics. I mean, such as top secret, secret, or WikiLeaks. And they miss the big picture here, and at least that's my point of view on this. The intent here by the administration, by the Obama administration, by the executive branch is to criminalize whistleblowing, period. I mean, it doesn't matter whether things are top secret, or the whistleblower exposed anything that is actually considered criminal by the government, criminal acts committed by the government. It's just irrelevant. The only thing that matters is, one, criminalize whistleblowing. Two, and this is one thing that I've been repeatedly telling people, how much worse than Bush is actually Obama. And that is to create the biggest and the most effective deterrent. Okay? And that's what it is. Because what this case establishes, whether he gets a few years or whatever happens in the end, is it's going to deter many people from coming forward. I am in touch with people who have blown whistles. I'm in touch with people who were considering blowing whistles within various government agencies. And when they look at this case, they say, uh-uh, things have gotten so worse, so much worse. I cannot take the chance. I cannot come out, go to Congress, go to anyone and expose wrongdoing. Because it doesn't matter whether what you expose is considered secret or top secret. It is that I am going to be punished and prosecuted. It doesn't matter what it is that I'm exposing. And I believe the administration is effectively accomplishing this. And the silence by the media and the Congress is actually 100% supporting this administration's position, which brings this to my question, and that is, unlike some of the whistleblowers we had, to a very little degree, my case, because again, mine was really blacked out, why is it that nobody's talking about Bradley Manning? And by no one, I mean not only the media, the mainstream media, which we already know all about the whys on those, but even the so-called whistleblower organizations. I mean, what happened? During the Bush administration, we had these organizations just holding hands with each other, coming out and creating all these shows. Some of them tried to make it really believable about standing up for whistleblowers, and now they've been quiet. What happened to those organizations, Chase?
Well, I think the big picture is, as always, the most important picture, and it's important that it get out. About whistleblowers and how they're treated under the Obama administration, yeah, he's been terrible. He campaigned as the whistleblower's best friend back in 2008. But he has gone after national security whistleblowers in particular with a vindictive fury. So President Obama's administration has launched 7 Espionage Act of 1917 prosecutions against domestic leakers in the national security context. And that is, again, more than twice as many as all previous presidencies combined. So this is clearly not the sunlight presidency that we were promised. But what can be done about it? Now, last week, Congress passed unanimously in both chambers the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act that will go a long way to protect federal whistleblowers in a variety of government agencies, with one enormous exception, and that's national security whistleblowers, the kind you were, Sibel. And this is terrible because this is where we need whistleblowers the most. We have made catastrophic mistakes in the name of national security in the past 10 years in particular, catastrophic mistakes that we've made in large part because we have not had adequate information and we have been starved as a public of relevant information. So this is a huge gap and very glaring. Now, about other whistleblower protection groups, I can say that the GAP, the Government Accountability Project, has been very strong about Bradley Manning.
And thanks to Jeslyn Radek, because they got a little bit smart and they ended up actually bringing in someone who was and is a whistleblower. And it's only because of her influence, because in the past they weren't. And I agree with you, they have been. And again, I just want to make sure that the credit goes to Jeslyn Radek, because she's the one who actually has stepped up, you know, and taken a good, strong position with these cases, including the Thomas Drake case. Go ahead, sorry.
And, you know, even if other organizations have not stepped up the way the Government Accountability Project has, I've seen a number of national security whistleblowers stand up for Bradley Manning, which is very encouraging. Jeslyn Radek herself and Thomas Drake, too, has been attending the hearings at Fort Meade to show solidarity with Bradley Manning. Morris Davis, Lieutenant Colonel Morris Davis, former chief prosecutor at Guantanamo, is now a witness for the defense of Bradley Manning, to talk about the Guantanamo leaks and how they did no real harm. I find this quite remarkable that someone who is the chief prosecutor at Guantanamo one year is a few years later now defending Bradley Manning. And Mo Davis is someone who is a whistleblower himself, because after he quit Guantanamo in protest of the political interference that he was getting, he had some job. I think it was somewhere in the military bureaucracy, but he was writing op-eds critical of Guantanamo and that whole system. So he was fired, and he counts himself as a whistleblower. So we do see some support from other high-profile whistleblowers like Daniel Ellsberg too. It's really a shame, though, that many left liberal organizations, whom one might have thought would support Bradley Manning, are nowhere to be found. I look at the Brennan Center for Justice that's attached to NYU Law School, my alma mater. And even though they just published last year a terrific report about the problem of overclassification and excessive government secrecy and what a terrible threat this is to our freedom and to our security, they are nowhere to be found about Bradley Manning. In fact, their leader, Elizabeth Goitein, has gone out of her way to trash Bradley Manning as someone who's just a little too far out. You know, they really defend him.
Well, my second question has to do, is totally related with Congress, and that is, again, in between 2002 and 2008, we had some congressmen and women, who actually came out and put this dog and pony shows. At least they put on a show, even though it was not meant to go, you know, far. It's always the case, but it mutually agreed shows that they put on in Congress. But we had people like, you remember, Peter, Congressman Conyers, and we had Congressman Waxman.
Yep.
And they demanded hearing. They summoned people from the executive branch. Well, what happened? happened to those guys? Where are they?
Well, it's really a shame. Really, the only two members of Congress who have stood up for Bradley Manning are leaving. And you have on the left Dennis Kucinich and on the right Ron. And they're both great libertarians, each in their own way, who support freedom and are against this crazy overclassification and craziness in the name of national security. And unfortunately, both are leaving. Ron Paul's retiring. Dennis Kucinich is a victim of redistricting after population shrinkage in my native state of Ohio. And who will take their place? Who's left? And again, so different from 40 years ago when Ginsburg could count on quite a bit of support in Congress, in both houses, by no means unanimous, but there were people in his corner. Why is this? I mean, I have my theories.
Well, I would like to hear your theory on this, because this truly points out to the real problem, the macro issue, and why the administration is able to go this far to escalate their war against the truth and whistleblowers and take it this far. Because as that woman says, I don't want to call her lady, it's too hard for me to do, Hillary Clinton, it takes an entire village, okay? And it takes the courts and to the state, they have been absolutely awful. It takes the courts, the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judiciary branch. And of course, the fourth branch, the mainstream media. And what we are seeing today is absolutely as a direct result of the all four working together unitedly to put our nation in this sad state, you know, with the First Amendment, with whistleblowers, with truth-telling. And that says Congress, you're looking at, 400 people? And outside those two that you just named, we have no one else, no one in the Senate? I mean, that is the real problem. That is the real problem that people should be looking at and screaming about. And this is what we should be looking at and chase. You know, we keep chasing the symptoms. You know, I was a symptom, Bradley Manning, but not the cause and the disease that is inflicting our nation, true disease that is inflicting our nation. And you mentioned Daniel Ellsberg. I want to hear your theory, please. I really want to hear that. I'm sure Peter does too, on why this is the case with our Congress today. But how did you feel about, talk versus action, et cetera? And Dan Ellsberg is someone I respect tremendously. He's a friend. His wife is a friend. But yet, he went and campaigned for the man who has been declared as the worst president in the entire history of this country when it comes to whistleblowers like Daniel Ellsberg. How do you justify that? I mean, I say actions really speak much louder than words, and I was traumatized when I found out that Dan Ellsberg, together with Ray McGovern, actually went out there and campaigned for the man who has been declared as the worst president in the history of this country when it comes to truth tellers and whistleblowers.
Well, this is a very complex question, I think.
And sensitive and delicate. We don't want to lose friends. I know. Go ahead.
Sensitive and delicate. But I think one reason why Ray McGovern and Dan Ellsberg, two great veterans of the intelligence community and defense community, have really spoken out and stuck their neck out for what's right in different ways. I think one reason why they publicly supported Obama was the fear, and I think it's an entirely rational fear, that a Romney administration was going to be even worse, not just with whistleblowers, but that war with Iran was much more likely under Romney than under a second Obama term, as awful as Obama has been when it comes to persecuting and prosecuting national security whistleblowers. But this is a discussion, I mean, that could go on for days and days about when do you support the lesser of two evils. I'd like to bring it back to the difference in the reception of Ellsberg and Ellsberg's leaks and Bradley Manning and his leaks, because I think it's very illuminating to compare the two and wonder why was Ellsberg greeted like a hero by so much of the mainstream media the whole intellectual class and even many members of Congress, whereas Bradley Manning has been by and large shunned, condemned as a weirdo. He has not been defended in the press. The New York Times has not sent anyone to cover his pretrial hearings, even though he's talking about the way he was tortured in totally gratuitous isolation confinement for almost a year against all medical advice. And the New York Times has done nothing to stick up for their source, because Bradley Manning is their ultimate source for so many stories they ran based on the WikiLeaks disclosures. So why the big difference? Well, you'd think that by now, 11 years after September 11, 2001, that we would have recovered some of our sanity as a nation, and that the politics of fear would not be such a huge driving force, that we would be beginning to see things a little more rationally, and that we wouldn't be on this permanent war footing. But the fact is, we are. Ellsberg, he was leaking his sensational disclosures after many years of widespread public protest against the Vietnam War, so there's some similarity there. The main reason why fewer people like Manning, but more people like Ellsberg, is back then, 40 years ago, 45 years ago, at the time of the Vietnam War, you had the draft, the military draft. Let me explain this. Most intellectuals in the media, in the nonprofits, in the legal profession, and in politics even, come from the middle class, upper middle class. And back in the time of the Vietnam War, there was at least a theoretical that their sons, grandsons, nephews, brothers, cousins might be drafted and sent to Vietnam to fight, possibly to die. Ever since the draft got done away with by Richard Nixon in 1973, intellectuals in the media, government, the legal profession, they really face no such threat to their family. And there's consequently no sense of urgency about our flailing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and who knows where next. These wars have been something that they have related to only by watching TV or reading newspaper accounts to a large degree. There's no chance that their child will get called up and sent to Afghanistan or Iraq or stop lost for a third deployment. So I think, consequently, there's no sense of urgency. Our media class, our political class, just doesn't have much skin in the game. And we've had these two wars going on in the past 10 years without tax increase, but with the tax cut, which is a further remove from reality, because these wars are, of course, immensely expensive. And it's as if they don't cost us anything psychologically or in blood or in money. And so there's no sense of urgency. And I think our intellectual class has just done a terrible job in considering the true toll and the costs of these wars. And when someone comes along and probably does break the law, like Bradley Manning does, just as Dan Ellsberg plainly broke the law, he has always admitted such, they have no sympathy whatsoever now the way they did then.
Couple of comments. First of all, Chase, I agree with you that because the wars appear to be so remote, and that's not just the drones, but we're so detached. And, you know, the cynic in me says, well, gosh, if we got Lady Gaga to attend the Bradley Manning court martial, or a Kardashian or three, that the media would be there snapping away photos, and indirectly they would be forced to cover the event itself. I also wanted to mention that Jesslyn Radack wrote an excellent analysis of this new Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, and in particular its lack of coverage of national security whistleblowers. And I do differ with Sibel in terms of the decisions, the private decisions that Ellsberg and McGovern made on a lesser of two evils basis. to publicly support Obama's reelection. I think that people wrestle with those issues, and I consider McGovern and Ellsberg to be people of true conscience, and I think that they didn't come to those positions lightly, and so I personally decline to judge them for that. I want to turn to the Article 13 aspect of the preliminary hearings at Fort Meade in the Manning court-martial, because this is where David Combs appears to have made significant headway against the government, and this may, you know, positively influence sentencing and the delicate plea bargaining efforts that we addressed earlier in our conversation, Chase. But Combs has made a strong showing with witnesses, including the hostile witness of the guy who was running the brig at Quantico, and the powerful testimony of Private Manning himself about the barbaric terms of his incarceration. And I wonder if you could give us some interpretation of military law and the Article 13 itself, and to what extent the grotesque mishandling, if I can put it that way, of the detention of Bradley Manning could undermine the entire case against him that the government has brought.
Well, there are two consequences, a strictly legal consequence and a political consequence to this, what I also see as a barbaric treatment and mishandling too, not just a crime, but a blunder in forcing Bradley Manning to be in solitary confinement against all medical advice for nearly a year. In a strictly legal sense, first. Now, defense attorney David Combs has raised a motion to have all charges dismissed due to the illegality of this treatment. Will that succeed? No, it will not. Denise Lind, the judge, will not dismiss and scuttle the entire case of Bradley Manning unless she wants to get transferred to the Aleutian Islands in time for Christmas. It's simply not going to happen. She's under pressure, too, to keep this going. But what might happen is that the time spent in gratuitous and quite sadistic isolation confinement will count triple or at an even higher ratio as time served when it comes to sentencing Bradley Manning. And that is, I think, the best that can be realistically hoped for from this outcome. And I think Combs has done a good job there.
You mentioned that you were in Washington earlier this week when David Combs spoke to a gathering there, and it's quite rare. He has restricted himself from press interviews and most public appearances. But he went to speak at a Unitarian church, and here's a quote, not only referring to the treatment at Quantico of Bradley Manning, not only was it stupid and counterproductive, it was criminal. An entire group of individuals, who I have no doubt were honorable, chose to turn a blind eye to how he was being treated. They cared about something more, the media impact. And on that, do you agree? Because I think they cared more about the chain of command and the very clear message that persecution of Bradley Manning, and I use that term intentionally, persecution was the order of the day, and that how that was rationalized, how that was made to fit into rules and regulations and a suicide watch, that was kind of after the fact. The harsh treatment, the Gitmo-type treatment of Bradley Manning, I believe was fully intentional.
Yes, I believe it was too, and it may emerge soon that the intent was to break Bradley Manning and to get him to implicate Julian Assange and WikiLeaks so there can be criminal charges pressed against Julian Assange should he ever be extradited to the United States, which is a very realistic chance. Let me talk a little bit about what this 11 months of pretrial isolation confinement really means, though, because I think it's been a political disaster for the prosecution. Even though we haven't gotten as much media as we would like, I think there is starting to be more media interest in this. Yesterday, for instance, the New York Times ombudsperson, their public editor, Margaret Sullivan, scolded the Times for not sending anyone there to cover it. Maybe they're going to respond. Certainly, there's been a lot of interest globally with the Agence France-Presse present, The Guardian present, and many foreign news outlets, too. And foreign pressure and news coverage matters a great deal. But when we look at this treatment, 11 months of solitary confinement, pre-trial, before there's any kind of conviction or trial, it's tempting to compare this to the way dissidents were treated in the Soviet Union, where often they were stowed in psikhushkas, psychiatric hospital prisons, where the assumption was that if you disagree with the government, then you must be crazy. So these dissidents were pumped with psychoactive drugs and confined. And there's appalling similarity to that. There's also appalling similarity to the way we treated people at Guantanamo and elsewhere. And many people argued that this harsh treatment, which the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture has called cruel and inhumane treatment. He stopped just short of but he has whether this is the war on terror coming home and now suddenly U.S. citizens are being treated like Guantanamo detainees. There's some truth in this, but I think we miss something very important if we stop there. We should remember that here in the United States, we have 20,000 prisoners in the federal prison system in long-term solitary, and we have a further 50 to 80,000 prisoners in our state prisons also in long-term solitary. Now, for many of these people being thrown into solitary, it's not really the last resort.
Chase, I agree with you, and I've done extensive coverage of the SHU, the Security Housing Unit, at Pelican Bay here in California. It is an abomination, and I credit the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York for leading important challenges. And to show you just how draconian it is, they have filed a case where they're asking the government to limit the use of long-term solitary confinement to 10 years. And they feel that's the best achievable result that they can get under the current climate. And I find that heartbreaking because we have men in solitary confinement in California who have been isolated for as long as 30 years. And the idea that this is short-term punishment designed to deal with the most recalcitrant inmates is a lie because it is used on such a cavalier long-term basis. So I just wanted to underscore your comment on that.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's become a punishment not of the very last resort for a short-term, but as kind of a first or second resort for the long-term. Now, so try to say, okay, but what about pretrial solitary? Surely that doesn't happen in the United States. But it does. It's not the norm, but it happens disturbingly often without getting too much of a public outcry. It's to justify the horrible treatment of Bradley Manning at all, far from it. Just to put it in context and to show that this kind of treatment is very much in the DNA and in the bone marrow of our penal justice system already. It's not something that came and infected us from Guantanamo, from our foreign adventures. And you could even argue, as some people have, that what we've done at places like Abu Ghraib and Bagram and Guantanamo is just to export the everyday harshness of our domestic, normal, so-called penal system.
Charlie Grainer, who was one of the guards at Abu Ghraib, who was convicted, and of course no officers, no commanders were convicted. One female commander was demoted, but no other higher-ups who permitted or authorized the barbaric treatment at Abu Ghraib were. And Charlie Grainer's life in America was he was a prison guard in Pennsylvania. And so your point there is very well taken. Chase, take a moment here to describe the testimony of James Averhart. He was the commander of the Marine Corps brig at Quantico, and he had some pretty testy exchanges with David Combs as he was testifying under oath.
Well, following this secondhand, so I don't have the keenest insights into it, but I think this demonstrates that David Combs is doing a very good job of impeaching the testimony of hostile witnesses and picking apart these arguments that what the Marine Corps did to Bradley by keeping him in solitary was for his own good. Now, the defense has done a great job of getting very articulate and extensive testimony from medical experts who had examined Bradley Manning and found that after his first 2 weeks in Quantico, he was no longer a suicide risk, not a risk of injuring himself in the least bit, and that they had found so with every single examination after every two-week period and got into some very testy exchanges themselves with the brig's commander, Everhart, and other people. And their medical expertise was ignored. It was ruled in favor of just the really things and the raw authority of Marine Corps commander. Mm-hmm. So again, I don't have any special insight into today and yesterday. No doubt, very exciting cross examination of the Marine Corps commander ever, but it shows David Combs is doing it.
And Chase, next, if you would describe your reaction to the fairly dramatic testimony of Bradley Manning himself.
This is extremely important that finally Bradley Manning himself is able to get up and say with literally his own voice what has happened to him. And most of the reporters who have been in the courtroom and heard him speak have come away very impressed at how self-possessed Manning is, how calm he is, how aware of the whole situation he is. And after so many unflattering smear jobs in the media depicting Manning as a nut job, as a self-involved, crazy little punk. Instead, you have this articulate, very somewhat humble, obviously intelligent voice speaking very clearly about the horrors that he suffered. And of course, it's all the more impressive because he is speaking so clearly and calmly about intense suffering that was inflicted on him, again, for no medical reason, no good reason whatsoever. And the more that the media and therefore the public hear from Manning himself, the more they're going to like him, the more they are going to see Bradley Manning as a responsible and individual and citizen. And they are going to start to question who really are the self-involved punks here in this. I think it's Manning's detractors in the government and in the media who have shown great irresponsibility in their duties as journalists over the past 10 years.
So, Chase, you're going to be covering the court-martial itself for The Nation magazine. It's now scheduled for sometime mid to late March. What are your observations here as we wrap up about what could occur between now and the formal court-martial itself and the extent to which what you just addressed, public opinion, about Bradley Manning may be shifting?
Well, I see the struggle to get some kind of clemency and real justice for Bradley Manning as a long-term struggle. It's a war of position, not a war of maneuver. And I've saved this spoiler comment till the end, but I fully expect Bradley Manning to be convicted and sentenced to a very harsh jail term, I think at least 40 years in prison. And I think those of us who do think that this is horribly unfair need to prepare ourselves for a long-term struggle for some kind of clemency, looking at the examples of the struggles to free or at least retry Leonard Peltier and Mumia Abu-Jamal, and learning both from the successes and, let's face it, failures of those two campaigns to free their guides. So I think the battle for public opinion is immensely important and will be ultimately at least as important as the what goes on in the courtroom, because ultimately there is going to be a conviction. I would love to say that this is an instance of a good system of laws that are being improperly manipulated to screw this one guy. And there's a little, you see that in the harsh treatment and the torture of Bradley Manning for 11 months in solitary confinement. But the real problem is bigger. It's a bad system of laws, laws that are designed to get this bad outcome of extreme secrecy, and laws that are designed really to punish whistleblowers, as Sybil Edmonds knows much better than most. And changing the culture of fear that we still suffer from, changing this legal system so that it promotes whistleblowing is a real struggle. And that's going to be part and parcel of the fight to get a real justice for Bradley Manning.
Chase Madar, attorney and the author of The Passion of Bradley Manning. Great to talk with you again, and we'll do it in the spring as the court-martial commences.
Thank you.
Give me absolute control over every living soul, and I have a sanity, baby. That's an order. Take the only tree that's left, stuff it up the hole in your culture. Give me a bank of burning wall, give me a star. I've seen the future, brother. It is murder.
Leo Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.